If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. On today's podcast, we're exploring the little-known story of Winthrop Bell, a Harvard philosophy professor turned spy who worked for MI6 to provide intelligence from post-World War I Germany. The information that he gathered was vital in shaping crucial diplomatic moments, including the Treaty of Versailles. But the full extent of his warnings of the Nazi danger has only recently come to light. Speaking to Ellen Evans, the author Jason Bell discusses his book, Cracking the Nazi Code, which delves into Winthrop Bell and his exploits.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, and we are talking today about Dr. Winthrop Bell, a man whose career as a secret agent spanned the two world wars, reporting from wartime and interwar Germany, and he issued stark warnings about the horrors of the Nazi regime early on. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today on the History Extra podcast.
Thank you, Eleanor, for having me.
Wonderful. I wonder if we can start by an introduction to Dr. Winthrop Bell, please.
He was a Canadian citizen and a British subject who worked for MI6. After World War I, he was the first to warn against the Nazi plot for World War II in 1919, and then he was the first to warn against Hitler's plan for the Holocaust in 1939.
So he's a hugely fascinating figure. He's at the center of your book, Cracking the Nazi Code, the untold story of Canada's greatest spy. I wonder, can you take us through his early years and how he came to be in Germany during the First World War?
So Winthrop Bell was a philosophy student. So he had graduated with his master's degree from Harvard University and then decided to go to Germany. That was the world center for philosophy at the moment. He first went to Leipzig, and then he learned of a promising new philosophical method called phenomenology that was being created in a university city called Göttingen. So he traveled there in 1911 and began working with Edmund Husserl, the founder of the phenomenological movement. Winthrop Bell was Husserl's first Anglophone doctoral student, and was just finishing up his dissertation in 1914 when the Great War broke out. So as a British subject, he was imprisoned. His examining committee actually went to his place of imprisonment to conduct the oral examination for the PhD. They voted to pass him with honors, but the university overruled the committee because they were outraged that a British enemy subject was going to be given the PhD. So Winthrop Bell was in the uncomfortable position for several years during the Great War of without having having his PhD. But the Germans had suspected him of being a spy when the Great War broke out. But all the evidence indicates that he was in Germany simply as a philosophy student.
So the sort of espionage secret stuff comes later. But if we can zero in a little on his time as a civilian interned, can you take us into that experience? Whereabouts was he and what was life like for him in these years?
Well, so he went to a prison camp called Ruhleben, which was near Berlin. So it was a former horse racing track that was quickly converted by the Germans into a prison for the British civilian prisoners of war. So towards the beginning of the war, late 1914, early 1915, Ruhleben was a horrible place. So there were, you know, guards were beating up prisoners and the conditions were miserable. Everybody was depressed. But early in 1915, the prisoners decided to pull themselves together and they had a lot of talent and money amongst themselves. So there were prominent British businessmen, cultural figures who were imprisoned in Germany, and they decided to finance Ruhleben as a cultural center. It was became a kind of a British outpost, a Little Britain, as they called it. So it featured musical theater, drama. They had intensive sports competitions that featured basically professional-grade competitions. There were numerous British professional athletes who had been also captured in Germany during the war. So it was, as far as prisons go, about as excellent as could be expected. There was even, you know, botanists there who were taking care of flowers and things like this. And yet it was, you know, far from perfect. So there would be prison escapes, and the prisoners would routinely be subjected to lockdowns. Occasionally, guards would beat up prisoners. There was one occasion when prisoners were forced out of the prison hospital after a breakout attempt, and several of the seriously ill prisoners died during that transference. So it was a mixed bag, but Winthrop used that time to perfect his skills in German, to develop the connections that would later get him his position with MI6, and to perfect his skills in French and in other fields as well.
So he's in Ruhleben for a number of years, interned alongside a lot of other nationals. He is, obviously, his time in Germany predates that with his PhD in Göttingen. So he's immersed in this culture. What does this mean for him when the Great War comes to an end in 1918?
He used his time in Göttingen wisely, I should say. So he was really working seriously to understand and to deepen his understanding of German. He would speak with the guards in German. There was a large community of Germans who were imprisoned in Ruhleben because they had the misfortune to have, for instance, been born in Britain. They might have been there for a couple of weeks, or they might have had one of their parents who was British. So when the war came about, they were imprisoned just like everybody else. And these were among Winthrop's close friends. His German was already very, very, very good when the war broke out. But by the end of his time in Ruhleben, it had really been perfected. He was also given the chance to befriend people who were politically influential. So one of them was a member of the Peace family, who was central to the Fabians, who were the kind of intellectual think tank for the ruling Liberal Party. And that would be key for Winthrop's future intelligence connections. But at this moment, he was totally innocent about these intentions for a future intelligence career. But what he had in his back pocket was an extensive network of friends in the German Intelligence Bureau. When he was a student at Göttingen, which was Germany's leading math and science university, he had befriended students who were among the most promising young German minds in math and physics. And when the war broke out, those graduate students and professors were recruited into German military intelligence. So these were people who trusted Winthrop completely. And in November 1918, as the German militarist government began falling apart and the democratic regime overthrew them, those friends of Winthrop's threw their hat in with the democratic cause. And in the couple of weeks that Winthrop was in Berlin after the war ended, but before he could be repatriated to England, he had intensive meetings with those people and gained an intimate interior understanding of what the German political and the military situation looked like. So at this moment, he really was the world's foremost expert, foremost Anglophone expert on the German military and political situation. He went to London a couple of weeks after the end of the war and began briefing British intelligence officers who were astounded by this portrait that he had to give them. So this was at a moment that the British were worried that communism was about to take over the whole of Europe. It was that Germany was going to be the next to fall. And Winthrop's report was that the communists were at that moment marginalized in Germany. The pro-democratic forces were in the ascendancy. But it was hard to tell this because the democratic forces were so busy trying to figure out how to govern the whole country. They had been so far from the halls of power, they didn't have the skills or the expertise yet. Meanwhile, the extremists on the left and the right were being noisy, pumping out propaganda. And so this gave the British British intelligence a really wrong impression of who was in charge. So Winthrop went in and was telling these British military officers what the situation looked like. And you can see that he was being directed to the right people in the British military intelligence system to get this news out. Later in the year, in December, he had a meeting with the Canadian Prime Minister Robert Borden, and Borden was astounded again about what he had heard. Winthrop informed Borden, for instance, and this is also what he would have told British military intelligence, that a faction of the German military had taken over Germany towards the end of World War I, and they were fighting the war, the Great War, as a race war. So this was an astounding bit of news. He said that group had been temporarily marginalized. They'd fled the country. They were living in neutral nations at the moment, but they were going to work to regather their strength. There was this golden moment where democracy was still in charge, and with some exterior support from Britain and from other places, democracy would flourish, and the racists on the right and the extremists on the left would wither away. Borden was deeply impressed by this and requested successfully that Winthrop Bell be hired with MI6, which was a relatively new organization at the time. They'd just been created several years earlier before World War I. But at that moment, post-World War I, MI6 was broke. There were austerity budgets in place. MI6 was needing to fire many of its agents throughout the world who had just risked their lives in the service. And so Winthrop, after meeting with Sir Mansfield Smith Cumming, who was the head of MI6, he also deeply impressed Cumming, a.k.a. C, the chief of MI6, its founder and its first head. But MI6 was in the awkward position of not having enough money to hire him. So Borden and Canada fronted the money for Bell's salary. And it looks like what happened is Canada paid for Winthrop's salary, and then MI6 paid his military expenses. And then Reuters, the press agency, which was Winthrop Bell's cover when he went into Germany again, covered his telegraphic expenses.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's great context as to why Bell then is such an asset at this time. He's obviously got this wealth of experience of living in Germany, of being interned in Germany, and this network of contacts that has been building over these years as well. Just to return briefly to what he reported on when he initially returned, there's this idea that is central to your book that Bell is the first to be couching the conflicts in these terms as a race war. Can you expand on that a little more so we're being clear for our listeners?
Now, Winthrop, I should say, doesn't know all of this in the beginning. He knows 1918 when he's reporting this to Borden, that in the upper echelons of German power, some kind of group had taken over that was fighting the war as a race war. He didn't quite know yet the sources of this, where it had come from. We know now from later historical work that it was General Ludendorff, who was the functional dictator of Germany towards the end of World War I, who was the chief race warrior. So this was somebody who in later years openly worshipped Odin, the god of war, and propagated this idea of the Aryans as being the chosen people and all the rest of the people in the world as being kind of parasites who needed to be destroyed. Ludendorff was the early supporter and enabler of Adolf Hitler, who ordered Hitler to be hired into the German military intelligence system post-World War I as a spy and helped support his career, his early career in Munich. Winthrop couldn't have known that in 1918, 1919, but yet he saw all the signs of this plot at work. So he saw the propagandistic attacks against the Jews that were being waged in the German military propaganda in the last years of World War I. He saw how after World War I, propaganda was going up in the streets of Berlin calling for the massacre of the Jews. And he was reporting to Reuters that there were organized attacks across the German nation against Jews on the streets and Jewish-owned businesses. So he couldn't yet know the cause of this, but he could see the effects of it. And he knew that this was supported by powerful figures. Towards the end of 1919, he was saying that this group of racists had again functionally taken over the German military. So they had controlled it towards the end of World War I. They were temporarily deposed in the November 1918 revolution. Democracy stayed in charge through late 1918 and then the beginning part of 1919. But by November, December of the following year, 1919, he said the racists had effectively regained control of the military and were powerful enough to take over the country, to take over Germany anytime they wanted. They just didn't want to yet because the political and the economic situation of the country was so unstable. So we kind of have a picture of Weimar Germany and Weimar democracy as holding on and actually being kind of the real power in the country right up to the Great Depression and when Hitler took over again. But Bell gives a very different portrait in his November 1919, December 1919 reports that Weimar Germany was effectively sunk. They were done as an organizing force. But they were being kept around by the Nazis unwittingly as a front. So this early Nazi group could rearm and plot World War II.
That's really, really great to dive in a little there into Bell's ideas. But I wonder if we can backtrack just slightly to talk about when he became operational in this sort of more official sense in 1919.
So Winthrop was in late 1918, MI6 decided to hire him on, and he went through a kind of a whirlwind training that lasted a couple of months, and he had to basically learn everything. So you can see him during this period meeting with MI6 experts in communications, in explosives, in hand-to-hand fighting. And then he's sent to the border regions with Germany to begin meeting with German diplomats who had quit the service during the war because they were outraged about the militarists who had taken over the country. So Bell, during that time, was gaining through these interviews with these diplomats a sense of who the people within Germany were who could be trusted. So when he went into Germany in the late winter, early spring of 1919, he realized that things had gotten far worse than when he left the country a couple months later. So the country was in a state of abject starvation. Hundreds of thousands of Germans had died owing to the continued Allied blockade of the ports. Something like a quarter of a million Germans died in the several months following the armistice owing to the starvation blockade. Conditions in the country were absolutely miserable. Terrible diseases, children were dying. So it was an absolutely terrible situation. And Winthrop saw that the political winds, which were extremely favorable in November 1918 for democracy, had suddenly turned in the opposite direction. So now democracy was being attacked by extreme left and extreme right-wing propaganda. And the Democrats were being blamed for the starvation and for having been suckered into signing the armistice with the Allied powers. So the Democrats really had thought that when they overthrew the militaristic government, that the West, the collective West, the democratic forces would welcome German democracy with open arms. And they were shocked when that didn't happen, when instead the Allied powers decided to punish Germany for the sins and misdeeds of the militarists, who are now off comfortably enjoying themselves in places like Sweden, formerly neutral nations. These militarists were had gotten themselves extremely wealthy through corruption during the war. So they were enjoying themselves while the German Democrats were being systematically starved. So in February and March, Winthrop begins issuing a series of urgent warnings to the British government and to the press through Reuters, explaining what was happening and that the food blockade needed to be lifted immediately before German democracy collapsed. And wiser heads prevailed for the moment. So in March 1919, owing in large part to Winthrop's on-the-ground investigations and his reporting, which were in turn going to Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill led the charge before Parliament. But quickly in March, after these reports were heard, the food blockade was finally lifted, which gave German democracy a bit of breathing room to survive for a little bit longer.
So what happens to Bell after sharing this intelligence, and how else do his ideas continue to be shaped by what he saw in 1918, 1919?
So his early reports, which help lift the food blockade, make him a rising star, not just in the intelligence network, but really in politics writ large. So quickly, MI6 has him on airplanes to Paris, personally briefing the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, the prime ministers of other nations. And in the spring of 1919, his work is transformative in convincing David Lloyd George to lighten the planned reparations burden that's going to be placed on Germany. So we now think of what happened at Versailles as being, incredibly vindictive. But the first draft of the Versailles Peace Treaty plan was a lot worse. So there were going to be much harsher territorial concessions demanded of Germany. For instance, much harsher financial reparations that were going to be demanded. And Bell, in his meetings with David Lloyd George, convinced him that if the initial draft of the peace treaty were pushed through, the outbreak of war was going to be immediate. And Bell saw this happening on the Eastern Front. Germany would invade Poland, and Poland in that position, in that moment, which had just been founded as a country again, would not have been able to withstand the onslaught, and the death toll would have been horrendous. So Bell was able to convince David Lloyd George, and instead what happened was a kind of a lukewarm compromise in which Germany was punished more than Bell and David Lloyd George thought they should have been, but less than Clemenceau and the French hoped that they would be. Bell, after these meetings with David Lloyd George in France and with other leading British figures, then would go back into Germany. He kept on filing these reports. And through the year, his reporting on the right-wing racist extremists became more and more prominent. So towards the end of December 1918, they were kind of a footnote. He said that these race warriors existed, but they were marginalized. Towards the beginning of 1919, they were a bit stronger. Their propaganda was gaining in strength. By the summer of 1919, they were in a position where they could organize racial attacks on Jews throughout the country, both on the street and ransacking Jewish-owned businesses. They were able to organize race massacres of Jews in Eastern Europe that same year. And then by the end of 1919, he said they had become the strongest single force within Germany, and this was Britain's last moment to act without losing control of the situation.
So throughout what you've been saying about Bell, his is a remarkable story of the prescience early on of the horrors that are to come. Is there anyone at this stage that you've come across so far that was saying similar things, reporting out of Germany at this time?
There was not. So Winthrop Bell was the first agent on the scene. And part of this is because of the way that MI6 had invested its talent during World War I. So they were placing their agents and sources largely in France and in Belgium because it was so important to figure out where the Germans were going to attack next. It would have been extremely difficult to have the right kind of connections to get into Germany at that moment, but Bell knew prominent people. including the speechwriter for the German chancellor. So he had his own kind of connections that let him get around the country in ways that other people couldn't. And another piece of evidence that shows that he was alone for a while there was that he was begging for help. He was telling headquarters he simply could not do this alone. He was doing everything. So he was doing diplomatic work. He was doing these military investigations. He was doing economic investigations. He was doing journalistic reporting. Meanwhile, he was sleeping, if at all, maybe 2 hours a night. And he said he could not keep all this up by himself. Later in 1919, I believe in the summer, on his request, the British military mission was set up in Berlin, just a couple of doors down from his hotel, which I'm sure was not a coincidence. And these British officers, military intelligence officers, were initially sent in as agents to destroy the communists. So again, this was the portrait that Britain had of communism as having escaped Russia. It was going to take over Germany, next would be France, and then London would be possibly the next to fall. Bell met with these officers and convinced them that the communists were not the danger. And then later that year, later in 1919, you can now see a kind of a symphony of intelligence reporting that was coming out of Germany that supported Bell's position that the communists were a marginalized force, that democracy needed to be supported, and that these militarists, these racist militarists, were a rising dangerous force. And in one of the instances we can see this is the group led by Ludendorff. So Ludendorff was still in Sweden, but he had trusted intelligence officers who were still in Germany. But they approached Britain with a coup plan. They wanted Britain to sign off on it, but under which they would overthrow German democracy and take over the country with the promise that they would defeat communism. There was initial support from some of the British officers in Germany. That was quickly squashed by higher-ups within the British intelligence network who had been personally briefed by Bell. Now, that's an instance, I think, if Bell had not been there giving this intelligence, you could easily see this Nazi plot as already having succeeded in 1919 of overthrowing German democracy. They knew exactly how to play this flute. They knew what Britain was scared of. And so Ludendorff and his trusted aides, of course, were not going to tell the British that they meant to make race war throughout the world. Instead, they were saying, on the cheap, we can get rid of communism for you. And that was attractive to some elements of the British military system. But fortunately, through Bell's intelligence reports, there was no way it could have carried the day.
How much were you able to uncover or find out about how Bell himself regarded the reception of his reports? Is he getting frustrated that things are being squashed? Is he feeling like he's being listened to? Can we characterize that at all?
You can tell from the places he was being sent and the people that he was meeting that MI6 was absolutely on board with his presentation. So they were getting him the right kinds of meetings throughout the world. And so he had a great amount of influence within the diplomatic intelligence services and also with military intelligence. But at that moment, the military was being defunded. These officers who had been the heroes who had fought the war, the British government was trying to figure out how to get rid of them because they needed to seriously cut budgets or raise taxes. And British people at that moment were not keen to raise taxes, so the decision was made to cut the military forces. But the problem was that MI6 was housed within the Foreign Office, and there were powerful figures there who could veto Winthrop Bell's plans. Now, he couldn't know yet the ultimate outcome of this, but at the end of 1919, early in 1920, things looked very promising for this rescue plan that Bell devised to save democratic Germany. So this was a plan that would have private financiers organize credits so that Germany could restart its business life, so that these young men who were being hired by the terrorist militias would instead have something better to do. They could get gainful employment rather than going to work for the extremist militaries. So Bell lined up in meetings with prominent British banks, financiers who were willing to fund this if the British government, in alliance with other governments of the world, arranged the backstops just in case the investments went belly up. So all of this was in place, again, with MI6 support and obviously with the tacit approval of people like David Lloyd George. But David Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom at that moment, was the Prime Minister of a coalition government comprising also the Conservatives, who had a very different agenda than he did. It was a delicate balance that Lloyd George was trying to pull off. It wasn't clear what was going to happen right up through early 1920. Bell's proposal for the financial rehabilitation of Germany was running throughout prominent British newspapers, alongside his alarming reports of a powerful German secret army that was being developed that had something like 1 million men under arms, far outstripping what the British had at that moment, for instance. So really, it was just hard to tell what was going to happen. Early in 1920, January, February, he realized that his plan had been vetoed. He didn't know by, you know, who had vetoed this. My book, using recently declassified documents, finds the culprits, people who shot down his plan. These were people who, well, one of them was proved himself later as a fascist sympathizer who was the architect of appeasement of the Nazis, and he saw the Nazis as being potentially a great friend of Britain and wanted to stand out of their way and let them do, you know, what they wanted. And Britain at that moment was not so worried about holding down Germany as it was about holding down America. Once Bell realized that his plan was blocked, he tendered his resignation and went back to Canada with some, you know, obvious despair, because he knew that at that moment the Nazis were powerful. They were planning to fight the Second World War. His intelligence report said they would be prepared to do so in a generation. It was going to take them a couple of decades to get their, you know, their artillery and their navy back up to where it needed to be, and to get the financing in place for the war. But he knew what was going to happen, and he also knew that he would be in a better position to stop it as a private citizen who would not be censored by people who had the authority, you know, to silence him.
So he retires from this life, having given these reports, having them seen the reception that they had. With the benefit of hindsight, we can obviously see his predictions and how they played out there. What happens in 1939? How vocal is he able to be? What's his plan of action then?
And just to maybe begin a bit with backtracking a bit, I should say in the period after he resigned as an official British spy, he stopped taking, you know, payments from MI6. He kept up with his intelligence work, but in a pro bono capacity. So he would write frequent reports to his former intelligence handlers, including people like Morris Hankey, who was a British spy master, General Neil Malcolm, who was head of the British military mission in Berlin. And so he kept warning them through the 1920s and the 1930s about what was happening. Bell also kept up his friendships with prominent people on the inside of Germany. And so he was warning Britain in the 1930s about Hitler's plans for future war and about the need to rearm. And there are indications that his warnings had an effect during this period, that Germany was rearming, that Britain would also need to do so. I make the case in my book that without those warnings, Battle of Britain could have easily been lost. And then early in 1939, Winthrop Bell had acquired a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf in German. And it was key that it was in German because the English language editions had excised many of the most offensive passages. And so he systematically read through Mein Kampf and was also comparing this with speeches from other leading Nazi officials. And in the early months of 1939, he realized that Hitler and his chief lieutenants were planning worldwide racial extermination. So beginning with the Jews, but then continuing through the Slavs, the Poles, the Ukrainians, the Russians, Asians, black people, other indigenous people. The logic of this Aryan supremacy was that other races would poison the blood of the Aryans and destroy the Aryans if they were permitted to exist. So they simply had to be gotten rid of. So Bell, early in 39, issued this warning to his contacts in the Canadian government. And that much is certain. I suspect he must have let his intelligence contacts in Britain know as well. We don't have positive evidence of this, But he also let his friends in the United States know, including Francis Dayok, who became a central figure in the OSS, the U.S. State Department, and the POND, which was a predecessor organization of the CIA. So these were all prominent organizations during World War II. So Bell, in the spring of 39, lets these official sources know about what Hitler has planned. And simultaneously, he works up the warning for the press. He sent this out throughout Canada to trusted newspaper editors. So this was at a time when, of course, the war hadn't started. Gestapo agents were active in North America. They were assassinating their enemies abroad. So he had to do this on the down low. But even after all the secrecy and getting this to editors who could be trusted and not blab who was sending this to them, Bell got a series of rejection notices back, saying in effect that he was pasting together passages to try to make Hitler look bad. So there's kind of two different things that are happening. I think that his intelligence contacts are taking his warnings seriously because he had proven himself to be a prophet, that his warnings of 1918 and 1919 had come true, that he'd showed that Hitler was a liar. Hitler, through the 1930s, was pretending that he was a pacifist who wanted friendship with neighbors. All this while, Winthrop was saying that this was cover for a planned war of revenge. So when finally 1939 came around and Hitler was becoming openly belligerent, there were reasons in Britain and in Canada and in America for Bell to be trusted. But still, the popular perception was that Hitler was, rowdy, but ultimately he was going to be, moderate in his policies. He wasn't really going to start any serious wars. He was a pragmatic figure. So Bell had to deal with that popular perception. Finally, when the war broke out in the fall of 1939, editors took more seriously his warnings. And in November and December of that year, 1939, his warnings finally appeared in the press in a Canadian news weekly called Saturday Night. And that was the first warning Hitler's plans for the Holocaust by year. So the next warnings appeared in secret intelligence files in 1941 and in the press in 1942. And here I should also mention that Winthrop Bell's contact at the U.S. State Department, Francis Dayok, wrote him a letter that year, 1939, and asked for a copy of the newspaper. And that was obviously for the purposes of showing that story around the U.S. State Department. And around that time, the U.S. State Department, the U.S. executive branch, began to illegally rearm Britain so it could win its fight. This was at a point in time when the U.S. Congress had said it was illegal to provide arms to either side of the fight. But through Bell's intelligence briefings, the U.S. executive branch knew what was going on. And they sort of winked and let this armaments illegally escape America to go to Canada and then to England for the defense of Britain.
We know now then that Winthrop Bell's reports and his intelligence and his ideas that were forming, they were very prescient. And I was going to ask actually about the tagline for your book, The Untold Story of Canada's Greatest Spy. I mean, you've outlined there the impact of his work, but I wonder if we can just perhaps leave listeners with that case for him being Canada's greatest spy.
Well, I frankly think he might be history's greatest spy, period. And so, he also gets to be Canada's greatest spy. But I think that if Bell had not have been there, the Nazis would have gotten away with what they were intending. And they had a very clever plan. And Hitler had a very clever plan for how you would destroy races systematically without anybody suspecting anything. And even when Bell began warning about this, it was such a shocking notion that many people just had a hard time hearing what Bell was saying, that Hitler seriously meant for this to happen. And again, even 2 years after the Nazis began the systematic race slaughters, that was the first time we even see secret intelligence files accounting for this. Even as these first reports came out about these race massacres, there was a tendency in the West to think that this was propaganda being issued by Hitler's enemies among the Jews and the Poles to try to make Hitler look bad so they could suck America into the war and so forth and so on. So I think that there were psychological reasons why people were willing to fall for Hitler's trick. But Bell was a plausible person because he had given such detailed, accurate intelligence to the British and the Americans and the Canadians in the aftermath of World War I. He could not be ignored. He couldn't be scoffed at. Nobody could say he was just trying to, trying to get America sucked into the war or whatever. So I think he's really the key reason why it is that people were nervous enough to rearm to fight the Nazis, but they were also willing to push back against Hitler's plans. Without that, I just don't see how the Battle of Britain could have been won.
That was Jason Bell, Cracking the Nazi Code, The Untold Story of Canada's Greatest Spy, is published by HarperCollins Canada and is out now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.